Welcome today to Interview Series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an interview with Jeff Kempeners, a top-ranking global executive, business strategist, and technology visionary. Jeff, you bring a lifetime of proven, world-ranking international business and technology leadership to our audience. Considering your heavy schedule, we thank you for doing this interview with us.
My pleasure, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Jeff, can you provide your insights into application migration and how that fits into a modern software development lifecycle and the software factory approach?
Sure, Stephen. So for me, software factory means taking the specialization of development to a slightly higher level. So that's going to encompass all aspects of software development lifecycle, from business-driven requirements gathering to coding standards and practices, testing, governance of the process, along with, and this is a very important point, along with accountability for performance. And what I mean by accountability for performance is that this should really be a metrics-driven process. Your software development lifecycle, your software development factory should definitely allow you to take a big bang approach to modernizing your software portfolio rather than sort of the one step at a time approach or the ad hoc in people's free time we'll investigate this. And that tends to work better for more of our high performing IT organizations.
Well, you just mentioned big bang. Can you describe this approach in more detail?
So application modernization or rationalization or app migration or any other term you wish to use, it effectively can be done in a variety of different ways. The most obvious approach is to modernize things as they become aging legacy or, in some cases, new legacy. So if you kind of look at the maturity curve or the age curve of a software development platform, it can start out as sort of, new and exciting, and there are a number of different ways that people can measure this, but the way I like to describe it is you've got modern, forward-looking sort of leading-edge platforms. Then you've got the space where most people tend to play, which is, proven, reliable, yet still modern, taking full advantage of modern hardware, modern software, modern sort of, memory management techniques and managed code and those types of things. And then you've got, some of the older items, so as things sort of approach legacy and then what I call aging legacy. So typically aging legacy is where a platform is out of support and you really can't bear to have things running in that environment for any longer. And I like to use Visual Basic 6 or VB6 as a good example of that. So as most folks in the industry are aware, in April of 2008, or very nearly 1 year ago, Microsoft discontinued all support for the Visual Basic software development environment. So that's the integrated development environment, or the VB6 IDE. That doesn't mean that runtime is out of support, right? So you can still run your VB6 applications. But what it does mean is that if you need to make a change to a VB6 app, or if you need to look at the code and recompile it in some way, or you've got some third-party plugin, or really any of the development activities surrounding a VB6 application are no longer supported by Microsoft. And so, and that includes software assurance or a number of other ways that you could sort of up the ante. The tricky bit then is, it's sort of like a FIFO or a first-in, first-out approach. As new apps get created, the oldest apps get renewed, and we continue on like that forever. Now, the problem with that approach, and again, going back to the VB6 example, people start to take a look at, okay, what are our really old VB6 applications, and when should we start to modernize those? And then they sort of take them off in little bite-sized chunks, and they redistribute them to teams that are maybe, not currently active on a development project. The problem with those is that oftentimes higher priorities come to the table. A modernization or a migration project usually is not as high a priority item as a new business or a new revenue opportunity project or something that's a little bit more business driven. In addition to that, skills are not readily available. So VB6 skills are more difficult to come by now, certainly, than they were a couple of years ago. The risk factor is high because you're aging legacy, things are starting to go out of support. And usually we would want to do that for as little dollars spent as possible. So we would take a long time solving the problem, again, taking it off in bite-sized pieces. The big bang approach is quite different from that, because what we do there is we we select a platform, and in this case we'll keep using VB6 as the example, and you choose to do all of your VB6 apps as quickly and efficiently as possible. So you'll basically say, we're going to do all of our VB6 apps in a big bang all at once. The beauty there is that you get scale economies, of course. You get better availability of skills because you're sort of cornering a development center with people who can feed off one another and can sort of relearn the platform environment. And, you know, it's a well-known phenomenon that, you know, medium to large size teams that are all focused on the same technology have a sort of a learning by osmosis factor. You can do it offshore or use lower cost delivery centers, and all of those things sort of amounts to a greater efficiency. Now, the real advantage here is that once you've modernized all of this stuff and you're striving for continuous improvement after that, so you're trying to make sure that you never end up on the aging legacy end of the spectrum again. So having a software factory and a continuous improvement mindset allows you to constantly keep your software up to date, making maintenance just sort of a part of doing business, but not on the burning platform side. Rather, you're staying ahead of the curve. And I don't know that I articulated that quite as well as I want to, but really the real meat of the issue is, rather than taking things that are on fire and putting resources toward them, tackle this problem early, modernize your entire VB6 environment or your entire Smalltalk environment or whatever your older Java environment, and you want to migrate it to a modern Java environment. Whatever the case may be, do all of those things at once in a big bang approach, and then set aside the resources and the software factory approach in order to make sure that you never find yourself in that space again. And we actually have some companies who've done that quite successfully.
So, you just talked about some companies who have done that. I mean, are you able to talk about that and give us some more examples?
Well, specific examples, we of course like to get their permission before we use their brand names, but I would mention that, a couple of large, particularly financial services companies who happen to have, a lot of VB6 applications. There was a time period during the late 90s and early on in 2000 and 2001 where people were solving lots of problems with VB6 applications. In some cases, they were converting Excel macros to VB6 apps. In some cases, they were just sort of propagating VB6 apps all over the organization. And they did indeed find themselves in that situation. Now, as the out of support life cycle came to fruition in April of last year, they started to realize that they really needed to get off of this platform as quickly as possible. And in this example, they chose .NET Framework 3.5 as their new target environment. They purchased Visual Studio Team Services and Visual Studio 2008, and sort of went on about creating a detailed and modern software factory. The beauty of Visual Studio 2008 and Visual Studio Team Services and the like is that it does give you that metrics-driven approach. So one of the things that they were able to do is they were able to very carefully measure developer productivity, time to value, earn versus burn ratios, and lots of other sort of fun metrics that you can put. Some cases going down to an individual level, who are the most who's writing the most lines of code per day, and then also examining, who has the least defects per number of lines of code and those types of things, so that they can give some coaching, not necessarily to replace their developers, but just give some coaching on, hey, if you slow down a little bit, maybe you'll get less bugs per lines of code and so on. So they created this software development factory, and then they chose to tackle all of their VB6 apps all at the same time. And they did use some offshore to augment some of that. They kept the highest risk stuff onshore with their developers who understood their business process the best. And they took a lot of the other items, and they went ahead and they shipped them offshore to a group of developers who didn't necessarily need to understand their business at a detailed level, but rather could reverse engineer and recreate the applications from scratch. At the end of about a 9-month cycle, they had completed all of their VB6 applications and had put them through a user acceptance test cycle. And then they spent the next 3 months actually doing what they called a refactoring project. I would say that it was really a point release or a 2.0 release of a lot of these applications, but they chose to call it refactoring, and who am I to argue with that? But basically what they were doing is going ahead and taking the applications and adding a lot of the nice-to-have features to them. So now that they had them all modernized, all big bang, you know, everything was up and running on .NET. They had the skills, they had the team assembled, and what better opportunity to tackle a lot of the things that they wish they could have done on the older applications, or, you know, let's tweak it over here to realign with our new business process, or, you know, hey, we're settling claims in a different way as an insurance company, so let's go ahead and adjust our claims application accordingly. Hey, we're doing loan origination in a different way, so let's, you know, go ahead and tie in these integration points. And so it was, you know, those last 3 months of their 12-month cycle were spent really modernizing and you know, sort of refactoring and adding new features and functionality. At the end of all of that, you know, then they took a team that they felt would be an appropriate size, and they went with continuous improvement. So the mantra then was, we will never find ourselves in this position again where we need to dedicate this kind of time and resources and energy to modernizing. And likewise, we don't want to ever find ourselves in a position where the code has gotten so old that we have a difficult time finding somebody who can recreate the development environment, someone who can understand the code in the way that it worked before. You know, a lot of the problems that come with trying to open up a maintenance project on a very old application. And so now what they do is, as a matter of recourse, they put sort of these event-driven flags, although they are human event-driven, where once per year they sit down with about half of their set of applications, so that every other year every single application has been looked at. So if I look at half of them this year and then half of them next year, then in a 2-year cycle I've looked at every single application. And a set of decision criteria are reviewed against the application, you know, what hardware is it running on? What software platform is it running on? What would, if we were to build it all over again today, what would that look like? And then at the end of that, you do sort of a delta, right? You do sort of a difference between this is where we are and this is where we would ideally be. And if that gap is big enough, they go ahead and launch a maintenance project. They go with a software improvement or a migration project, and they remodernize that application right then and there. Now, they've been through about a 2.5-year cycle on this, and they're finding that that's working very well. And moreover, what they're finding is that it reduces their overall risk and their overall effort, because they don't have to wait forever in order to sort of, you know, take these things off the shelf. Now, there is one point I want to make about that, and it's slightly counterintuitive to some people. And it took some convincing, frankly, because where the counterintuition comes into play is that some people believe that when you build an application, you need to leave it alone for some period of time before you can really realize a return on investment on that application. So that is to say, if I write an application and it costs me, you know, $500,000 to do so, I want to wait a couple of years before I touch it again, because I want to make sure that I get a full ROI on that $500,000 that I spent. And that really comes from a mentality of writing software that was built to last. What we're seeing more and more is that because businesses are valuing agility, because software needs to change as rapidly as the business dynamics around you need to change, and certainly this is an interesting point in time to make that point. It seems to me and to many others that nowadays software, rather than being built to last, needs to be built to change. And so as such, putting it on a modern platform and evaluating it at minimum once every other year, modernizing it when it needs to be done rather than at some point down the road when it's so painful that it has to be done, it seems to be an approach that's working quite well.
Well, that's really interesting, that sort of this whole idea that you talked about. That sort of lends me to another question. You know, some say that high performers don't need the help of a consulting company. What are your views on that?
I would agree. I think that what's interesting is that if you put yourself in their shoes, once you're sort of in the continuous improvement mode, ideally you don't really need a consulting company, unless of course you choose to do that continuous improvement with an offshore capability or a nearshore capability or some delivery center capability in order to keep your costs lower. And certainly there are some companies out there who conscientiously make the choice to use a consulting company to augment their staff, you know, around their software maintenance or their software migration. However, they don't find that they have to, and I think that that's an interesting point. If you're behind the eight ball, if you're behind the curve, if you've got lots of stuff out there, and you feel like you're sort of running in front of a train, so to speak, New applications are coming in the door faster than you can modernize the old applications, then you know at some point in the future you're going to have a real problem on your hands. You're going to have a set of applications that's just so big that you're not going to be able to tackle it with the staff that you have. And that's sort of the metaphor of running in front of a train. Sooner or later, you're going to get hit. So how do you create greater efficiency for your modernization process? And that greater efficiency really comes into play with the software development lifecycle and a software factory. And it also comes into play on slightly aging to very current and modern is a relatively easy migration to do. Very, very aging legacy to modern is actually a very difficult migration to do. It's not a straight port. There's no tool that makes it whiz-bang and simple, no matter what the sales guy tells you. At the end of the day, it's a lot of hard work, frankly, to go from an aging legacy platform to a modern platform. And what we're saying is take that work in incremental pieces, and you'll actually realize greater efficiency, because if your developers are thinking about .NET, then moving from .NET 2.0 to 3.5 isn't such a big hurdle to tackle, or 1.1 to 3.5, or whatever the case may be. Moving from VB6 to .NET 3.5, now you're in a much different scenario. That's going to be considerably greater effort. And so don't let yourself get to aging legacy ever again, and theoretically, you'll gain the additional efficiency that you need to be able to handle these application modernization projects just within your own staff. Now again, some people do choose to use companies like Avanade for our, very large offshore capability and our delivery centers in places like Montreal and others, so that they can keep costs low, number one, or to allow their own developers to focus on the development of new applications that, are business process heavy, or to do the, as I alluded in the earlier example, to do some of the, higher risk stuff that requires a very deep understanding of business process. And so oftentimes they feel more comfortable with their developers doing that stuff and, sort of offloading to a consulting company some of the other lower risk items, or in some cases the higher risk items, but, those are decisions that need to be made by each corporation. So.
So far you've been talking about this whole idea of excellence in the software development life cycle. So it sounds like you see that as a prerequisite to what kinds of success?
Excellence in software development life cycle is probably most a prerequisite to success in keeping your application management and your application maintenance costs low. Moreover, it's certainly a prerequisite to having a metrics-driven application lifecycle process, and I can't stress enough just how valuable that is. If you're using some of the older tools and you're thinking about maybe going to Visual Studio Team Services or something like that, we can get a lot of advantage out of the metrics in particular. And I would say that having SDLC in place and having a metrics-driven approach is really going to uncover some real gems of wisdom in places, in opportunities of places where you can add considerable efficiency to your processes today. And then, of course, just sort of the obvious, and that is, keeping away from the very high cost of long-term aging legacy. The last thing we want is another, set of COBOL applications on our hand, because what the most difficult thing about migrating COBOL is the availability of COBOL developers. Well, if you go back a generation or so, we never would have dreamed that COBOL development skills would be in short supply. It was something that every developer knew how to do. But certainly nowadays, COBOL development skills and the ability to read and understand and reverse engineer a COBOL application and modernize it, that's extremely expensive prospect, because those skills are in very high demand because there's not very many. It's really a supply and demand factor. It's not that demand is so great, it's just that supply is very, very low. And so you really want to make sure that you don't get yourself in a position where a lot of your applications are running on a platform that has a low supply of development and technology skills.
We always talk about SOA, or you hear quite a bit about this in the news and have been for quite a number of years. Where does SOA help?
Well, the SOA has officially come out of the pit of disillusionment on the hype curve. And so, we're starting to get a pretty detailed understanding now of places where it can help and where it cannot. SOA is not the silver bullet that solves everybody's problems all the time, but in this case, it actually does provide quite a bit of an advantage. And I'll tell you that if you've got a really, truly segmented service-based application where, you know, you've got true process isolation from, you know, from one set of services to another, where, you know, sort of the core application that provides the business functionality is really more or less an aggregation of service calls. You know, so we're calling like a get policy details and a, you know, a get user information service, you know, those kinds of things, that it's a coarse-grained invocation of services with, you know, with very well understood interfaces between between the aggregate application or the composite application and the services themselves. Now, if you have that, it's very easy to imagine that in a continuous improvement environment, if I want to modernize one of those services, I can do so with very little disruption to any of the other services or any of the applications that consume that service. And the way that I do that is simply by not breaking the contract or the interface between the composite application and the service. So if I've got a service today that takes, you know, takes a loan object in and returns, you know, some populated information about, you know, about risk scores and you know, proposed rates and so forth as the output. That input and output object are well understood by the organization. Hopefully, they were part of a domain-specific language defining process, and you've got a, you know, a well understood interface. So I can blow up that service completely and recreate it, you know, brand new, as long as the interface looks the same way. Rewire the composite application to point to my new service, and theoretically nothing has been affected at all. Then once you've done all of the services, then of course you can pick up the composite application and modernize that as well. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it gives you sort of encapsulation of projects. You can do them in manageable chunks, one service at a time.
You know, just fascinating. I can really see the benefits of SOA, you know, service-oriented architecture. I'm going to go into another sort of kind of question, and that is how is, and where is application modernization an opportunity?
So any situation where the business is asking for features or functionality to be incorporated into an application, but you are currently unable to do so for one reason or another that is associated with technology. So either you've got a fragile application that nobody wants to touch it because if you do, it might break. Maybe it's grown organically over some, you know, some number of years, and you know that, you know, you don't really know where you would insert that functionality if you needed to, because it's sort of a term we like to use is spaghetti code, right? It's sort of all over the place. And that's, you know, that's a pretty obvious place where modernization can create an opportunity. And you know, by moving that over to a modern application platform, your developers would be much more comfortable opening up that environment and helping to create that new business functionality. So you may be missing revenue opportunities because your business folks can't get the functionality that they need into their current application set. Whereas if that were a modern application, you know, taking full advantage of SOA, you know, taking full advantage of a software development factory and lifecycle driven approach, you could open up that project, you could open up that application and create that new business functionality. And the other big opportunity is that it just drives greater efficiency. And I want to go back, is it provides you an opportunity to really keep very close accountability for what your developers are working on, what is their productivity, you know, how are they adding value to your company. And that gives you a business case to grow your development team if you need to. It also gives you an opportunity to find places where you can improve on your current skills, or sort of upgrade or top grade your current skill set. And there's, you know, so, sort of lots of efficiency gains in there as well. And those are probably the two big opportunities, new revenue opportunities and a gain of efficiency or a cost takeout on the supply side.
What do you see as the top opportunities and innovations as an outgrowth of our discussion today?
Well, I'm hopeful that one of the things that this does is it really brings people back to the table to talk about SOA, because I do think that there's a lot of advantage there. I think that that's a great opportunity. I think that some of the other innovations that we'll see is people will really start to get a good handle on governance of their application portfolio. You know, so I'd really like to see more companies, you know, more frequently evaluating their current application set and, you know, making smart decisions about when they're going to migrate. And I think that one of the main innovations there is we're going to see some tools start to crop up around some of these ideas. So in particular, you know, some of the things that we've seen already is you know, some neat tools on, excuse me, on endpoint virtualization for the SOA world. So that is to say, you know, we sort of virtualize the service from the composite application in such a manner that we can create another composite application that is the same exact sort of template or the same interface. And then we can just sort of, you know, flip the management tool to say, okay, from now on, the virtual endpoint points to this physical service rather than that physical service. And that allows us to sort of, you know, to do modernization of our services one at a time with literally zero downtime. So we sort of put that virtual layer in between. I think we're going to see more of that. We're going to see more comprehensive management tools for managing the endpoints of service calls so that we can, you know, more easily migrate and modernize composite applications and service calls in between. And I think we'll also see some, you know, some tooling around developer efficiency. And, you know, Avanade has taken it upon ourselves to develop our application lifecycle management plugins for Visual Studio Team Services. And those provide, you know, some pretty substantial add-ons in terms of reporting packages that gives you a sort of a deeper view into what your development and sort of cross-project productivities look like. So my hope, again, is that, you know, we're going to get back to SOA, and you know, we're going to see some interesting innovations in the tools that surround the way that we do some of these modernization projects.
Can you delve into the top risks for businesses today?
Well, I think the number one risk is to do nothing. You know, I know that that's you know, that's not a very welcome message for a lot of people, but I really do believe that's true. Most of the organizations that we found that are really in a bad place, that are really in a position where they need a lot of help, and you know, they've got a lot of pain, and their business users are highly unsatisfied or highly dissatisfied, and they really have a lot of work to do. Those are the organizations that chose, for better or worse, to do nothing, and to, you know, to sort of milk the application return on investment for as long as they could. And sooner or later, that goose stops laying its golden eggs, and you've got to you know, you've got to find a way to bring, you know, your customer satisfaction back up. One of the other risks is support. You know, you don't want to be in a situation where your VB6 applications feel just like your COBOL applications, or your Smalltalk applications feel just like your COBOL applications, where everybody is afraid to touch it because nobody works here. Nobody who works here anymore understands it anymore. You know, that's a pretty bad spot to be in, and it's a spot that we've seen a lot in the COBOL world, and I would say that it's a big risk to make sure that you don't get that in some of the sort of currently aging legacy platforms today.
Now, Jeff, I just completed a keynote at the Deans of IT Summit just a few weeks ago, and there's a lot of interest in sort of the changes in technology. If you were to design an ideal curriculum, what kinds of things should it have? Like, for example, shouldn't have VB6 or VB kinds of languages in there. What should it have in it?
Well, it certainly should be technology agnostic. You know, and by that I mean, you know, we shouldn't focus on one platform or another, one source technology or a target technology or another. You know, one of the things that I'd really like to see brought to the forefront here is a focus on governance. I would really like to, I think in order to be certified as sort of a high-end professional development shop, you really need to be metrics driven. You need to have, you know, really good governance model in place. You need to have just a very deep and thorough understanding of the day-to-day activities of your organization. I think if you were to go around to most of the IT shops out there, you know, particularly in the U.S. and Canada, you would find that there are lots of developers who are working day to day. You know, they're there 8 or 9 hours a day. They appear to be, you know, productive. But if you were to even ask their immediate supervisor, what is this guy doing? You know, that person might not be able to answer. And I think that that's a little bit more common than a lot of people realize, is they'd say, oh, they're working on such and such a project, or maybe even, oh, they're developing such and such a module. But can you get into the details of how? Can you get into the details of, you know, how many different trial and error runs have they made at this particular piece of functionality? You know, how many defects did they introduce into the broader scope of the application? And you know, how effective are they, you know, as an individual contributor, as well as, you know, having this person on the team, does that tend to bring, you know, other members up or down? It really becomes much more of a team sport activity, which I think is kind of interesting. And I would say that, you know, if I was looking at a global certification or professionalism program, I would want those metrics and that deep understanding and that governance aspect to really be at the forefront of the process, so that, you know, one of the great sayings is, you know, measure twice, cut once. You know, I think in the software development world, we're just now learning how to measure. And I think that it's important to remember that, you know, taking accurate measurements and taking baseline measurements and seeking to continuously improve against those measurements is a key part of any manufacturing or engineering process. And it's something that we're just starting to gain the maturity to do in software development. And I would like to see us get a lot better at measuring, at making measurements part of our standard practices, and evaluating the data that comes as a result of that measurement in order to continuously improve our governance and our procedures.
You know, Jeff, this brings up an interesting point. I know that Avanade publicly came out in support of a global certification of professionalism based on common standards and best practices and so on. And you've been providing, your organization is providing some in-kind support. And of course, there's negotiations and talks going on to expand that support. So can you provide an update on your work involving global certification and professionalism programs?
Well, of course, we'd like to continue to support that as best we can. And there are a number of places throughout the world where, you know, where the certification bodies carry a great deal of weight. I think that it's interesting that it varies from one location to another. Avanade has a unique opportunity as well as a unique challenge all in one, because we are a global organization. In some parts of the world where we operate, the standards and certification body is absolutely, you know, highest priority. You know, our employees and our developers are very plugged into that community. They're very deeply involved in it, and they care about it a great deal. Other parts of the world, they frankly don't care, which, you know, is, again, that's sort of the challenge part of the opportunity and challenge. And certainly, you know, what we're trying to do is take a think globally, act locally kind of approach, where, you know, we're putting out sort of, you know, global level thought leadership and understanding, but then really leaving it up to each locality to do what is right for them. And you know, the last thing we want to do is force everybody down a road where in some places it doesn't make sense. But having said that, we also don't want to leave that road untraveled, because there are a great many places inside of our portfolio of locations where, you know, that type of standards and standardization certification processes is a very valuable thing.
I guess I just should provide a bit of background when I was talking about your support for this Global Certification and Professionalism Program. This was tied in with the UN-founded International Federation for Information Processing. Mm-hmm. That organization's in about 95 countries, involving, I guess, about 1 million IT leaders and influencers, though their impact is probably something like 100 times that, because they have deep ties or former relationships with both business and industry, governments and academia, community internationally. So, again, you know, there's been the support for that program from IFIP, this international federation, and this program called IP3, the International Professional Practice Partnership, which has already started launching their Global Certification Professionals Program this year. So it's just remarkable that your company will go out front and provide this kind of thought leadership and support for this program.
No, it's been our pleasure. And certainly there are some household names in the mix as well. I mean, you know, it's IEEE in the U.S., it's CIPS here in Canada. You know, those are two names that, you know, presumably a lot of the listeners would recognize, and you know, those are the types of organizations that that are in the UN founded IFIP organization. So,
or even Microsoft itself providing public support as well and in kind support for this program. So,
indeed,
just
yes.
Simply remarkable. Well, we come to the end of the interview, and this is where I sort of turn the tables, and you're kind of familiar with this. Some people say, Steve, you know, you should never do that, but I love this part. Now, what questions would you ask? What would be your answers if you were doing this interview?
Well, I would want to know why is there such a why is there such a deep-seated need, Jeff, for metrics-driven development? And you know, don't I run a risk of alienating or potentially alienating or you know, potentially making some of my developers a little bit nervous with this approach? You know, is it really all that necessary if I've got really good and tight management and small working group teams? You know, aren't they going to keep each other honest and accountable and everybody's pulling their own weight and so forth? Is it really necessary to move to this sort of metrics-driven model? And by the way, I think we do a pretty darn good job of software development. So what do you mean, you know, when you say software development factory and you know, moving toward a higher degree of excellence? I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. I guess if I was, I would challenge me a little bit to prove it. And the way that I would answer that is, you know, there's sort of a sphere of things that we've all seen and we've all understood and known. And really all I'm doing here is acting on, you know, some of the things that I've seen over the course of the last particularly 12 to 18 months, and particularly what's happening in the VB6 space, frankly. You know, that's what brought a lot of this to the forefront for me. I did see it once before. It was in the 90s. It was with another set of technologies that will remain nameless that had suddenly become very legacy. But it's just really a set of observations, and it's a grouping of observations based on talking to a lot of you know, C-levels in our client portfolio who, you know, see this coming, see a need for a change, as well as, you know, working with some of the international standardization bodies and sort of, you know, looking at it through that lens. What do we need to do better and how do we go about doing it better? And, you know, that's really where I'm coming from. Now, as far as why does all this metrics-driven stuff have to happen, at the end of the day, teams do absolutely hold each other accountable. Particularly if you have small working group teams where everybody really needs to pull their own weight. And I'm not saying that that's a bad approach. Certainly, you know, a number of us have made, you know, lengthy careers working no other way but that way. But I will say that when you provide those same working groups an opportunity to even look at their own metrics in a very non-judgmental way, I'm not saying that you do a better or a worse job than the person sitting next to you. I'm not saying that this is too many or too few defects per lines of code or too many or too few lines of code per hour. All I'm saying is here are your metrics, and as you examine those and think about your working style, is there a place where you yourself can come up with some of your own improvement ideas? And leaving that as a place to start often takes some of the edge off, if you will, some of the, you know, oh, now all of a sudden we're, you know, it's likened to truck drivers when you first put the, you know, the GPS tattlers in, right? You know, then all of a sudden, you know, do you really want to know how much I was speeding on my way here? And, you know, do you really want to know, you know, how many breaks I took along the way? And, you know, and do you really want to know whether I skipped a way station or not? You know, those were some of the questions. Well, there's a lot of things that we really do want to know in software development, and I think that there's a lot of room for us to improve our processes if we better understand those things. And, you know, treat it as an opportunity, be very open and very, you know, very open and very collaborative with the developers who you're measuring. Give them an opportunity to identify their own areas for improvement, and they won't feel like it's a new way for their manager to look over their shoulder, but rather they'll think of it as a new way for them to develop and sharpen their own saw and develop their own skills even better so that they can be more effective in their position.
Well, Jeff, you know, we will continue to follow your significant contributions. You know, you are a top-ranking global executive business strategist and technology visionary. Really, we're very fortunate to have somebody of your significant contribution and history of success come to this forum today to speak with our audience. So again, we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with us.
My pleasure, Stephen. Thanks for having me.